You are listening to the Nurturing Birth Doula podcast, where we aim to dispel the myths, debunk the stories, and help people better understand the role of the doula in the 21st century. I am your host, Sophie Brigstock, owner of Nurturing Birth and course facilitator, and I invite you to grab a cuppa, pop on your headphones, and listen in as I chat to doulas, birth keepers, and nurturing birth friends about all things perinatal.
Welcome, everybody. So lovely to have you here today. Today, I am joined by Kate Greenstock. And Kate has an interesting journey to share with us, having been a doula and then become a midwife, and now having released her book, Flourish, which I want to really dive in and explore far more. So, Kate, welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So what I love to do here is to give people the opportunity to introduce themselves, because you know far better than me what your journey has been.
Brilliant. Well, it's so nice to be with you, Sophie, and everyone who's listening. I am now a midwife. I was for about 10 years a doula and had done doulaing in different places in the world. So started off in Abu Dhabi, also in the UK. And for about 15 years, I've also been coaching primarily women who are reimagining their work lives, wanting to rediscover who they are in the context that they're in, or moving into entrepreneurial pursuits. So my vision always one day was to bring the birth world together with my coaching. And then, there was a moment where all of a sudden I thought, I need to train as a midwife. And it's not like it was the first time I'd ever had that thought. I'd thought about it many times, actually, over that decade of doulaing, and always dismissed it as, this isn't necessary. I'm engaging in activism and, you know, doing great work in both supporting one-to-one and shaking up the system from the outside, and I can probably be more effective there. But something just kept nudging at me, and made the transition to becoming a student midwife and then a midwife. So it's been a journey from there, of course, within there, working currently in Southwest London as a continuity of care midwife, and so doing 3 days a week doing that, and then spending the rest of my time either coaching or most recently writing, because I've been writing this book for the last 2 years.
Amazing. And I suspect that that has been a whole birth process in itself.
It has indeed. It's been quite a journey. And I think my original vision, which was on New Year's Eve 2020, which we all remember as the New Year's Eve where we didn't go out.
Yes.
So preparing for a night in with my family, I had a little picture in my head of a little book. It was quite literally a little book, and I thought, I could write a little book, and it's evolved from there and isn't quite so little anymore, but it is very accessible. And the idea is it's for midwives, and it gives midwives a chance to go, I feel seen, I feel heard, and I feel like there is space within this book to reflect on who I am and who I want to be in the setting that I'm in, but also pick some tools, some mindsets, which are going to enable me to sustain myself and to sustain my colleagues. It's very exciting.
What an extraordinary challenge to set yourself.
Well, as you say, it started being little.
I was going to say, because it's not a little book anymore, is it? Flourish is a flourishing book. It's really... it's deep. It's a really deep dive into a lot of the challenges that face midwives. And I would venture those of us who are in the birth world. There was a lot of it that I was reading and relating to the doula journey too. For example, you talk quite a lot about, you describe them as mega mountains. And those are the challenges, aren't they? That, for example, the concept of burnout. I mean, I don't know for you, but I remember when I became a doula that the average lifespan for someone who was doulaing was about 2 years, that people would, you know, doula for that time and then hit the wall. they would
interesting I didn't know that. I mean, obviously you have the overview because you get to see the kind of life cycle of the doula almost. It's not that dissimilar to midwives, really. We know that there's a big attrition rate within the first 5 years.
Yes, extraordinary. And I used to do quite a lot of work with student midwives in Southwest London, going in and talking to them about the role of the doula, which was always fascinating because when I went in, and this was with third year students, I would be greeted often with quite a lot of closed body language. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But by the end of an hour long session, where it was very much inviting an open conversation, I would have so many of them coming up to me, sharing their stories, asking questions.
Yeah.
And so many of them sharing that they might not continue, they might not even complete their degree courses. So I'm painfully aware of how challenging it is to be a midwife in this modern day and age. And I am so blown away by anyone who steps into that world. I've said it on the podcast before, there's no way that I could do it from an energetic capacity, let alone anything else. Mm. But I have such respect for anyone who does, because as you point out in the book, the physical, let alone the emotional challenges, are huge, really huge.
They are. And we're only just coming to terms with that.
Yeah.
Or allowing ourselves to see more clearly the physiological damage, really. I mean, if we're honest, that we're doing to ourselves.
Yes.
Through night shifts, but also just chronic stress.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you're absolutely right. It's pretty awe-inspiring. And it's awe-inspiring seeing all these 18-year-olds coming into this world.
Yes.
Because, of course, the profile, at least in England, where we've lost the support for the fees for the course, the profile is changing of age of midwives. So it used to be majority mature students. And now it's majority people coming straight out of school.
Yeah.
At least... I haven't seen the figures for the whole country, but at least locally.
Yeah. So I'm intrigued, for those people who are coming in, what's the draw? What is it that they expect the role of the midwife to be?
Mm.
And how does that shift?
Interestingly, I've had conversations like this with a couple of students recently. They used not to be able to get in if they thought that it was all about babies.
Yeah.
And that's probably still true. I mean, it's like a core element of really getting to the heart of it is saying, no, we're going to be about being with women.
Yeah.
But I think if someone hasn't worked elsewhere ever, you know, has really not been in the world of work at all, perhaps coming into the draw in itself is, you know, something interesting and diverse, and it attracts very practical people who also like variety. You know, all of that is a draw.
Mm.
And, you know, many of whom have got quite developed views on feminism and identity, and, you know, and we all know that midwives want to be midwives because they like the idea of being an autonomous practitioner. And I think even much younger student midwives understand that. There's this exposure straight away into the world of work, aged 18 or 19, which is brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to name it, really. It's hard for anyone, but when you've never worked in that way before, and you're not continuously working, but you're working about 50% of your time on the course, and you're spending on the weeks that you work as many hours as a midwife would be working, with as erratic shifts and all the other physical and emotional exposure that a midwife's getting.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's, given that this is a doula podcast, I'd love to know a little bit more about your doula journey and where you feel the similarities are in your role now as a midwife, and what you feel you have really been able to bring in from your doula role.
I love this question because I'm all about bringing all of me and everyone else being able to bring all the elements of themselves into their work. So Yeah, I was a birth doula for 10 years, working in partnership with lovely Sally Ann Holman. And I suppose I brought in presence, being with, being able to just be with emotional challenge, be with intensity. That's the main thing. That's the main feeling of, I mean, all the experience as well, of course, experience of variety of birth, experience of physiology, but not from a clinical perspective, but trusting that it's normal and it's okay. And of course, my education, midwifery education, had that intention as well to build trust. But the level of exposure to normal birth, as you know, is relatively low. So I felt like I had a grounding. And when I say grounding, I really mean 2 feet on the floor.
Yeah.
Knowing that fundamentally this is a safe process, which is rich and beautiful and powerful and all the things we know about birth.
Yeah.
And sometimes, for whatever reason, things take a different course.
Yeah.
And that has never left me, you know, and I guess it was a question mark in the minds of, well, in my mind, but also in the minds of perhaps my lecturers, sometimes some of my mentors, as to whether I would have a kind of epiphany and see things differently. But I don't. And yes, of course, I'm much more aware of potential, you know, vulnerable moments clinically, all of that stuff. But fundamentally, that's the place I'm coming from. And it's such a helpful place, because it means that fear plays less of a part.
That's really interesting, because that stood out to me in the book. You talk quite comprehensively about trauma and about post-traumatic stress injury rather than disorder, which I found really interesting. I have a real fascination and interest in trauma, and am doing more and more learning and working with trauma. And you talk about the sort of the fear culture that exists within the maternity setting. And I suppose I'm very aware of fear within, you know, as a doula, how that exists within the maternity world. But I'm interested that you're saying that as a doula, that gave you that grounding and that trust in a physiological birth process.
Yeah.
And an opportunity I expect to witness a lot of physiological birth unfolding before you even stepped into midwifery.
Absolutely, both at home and in hospital.
Yeah, yeah.
And in different places in the world as well.
Yeah.
With different pressures, I guess, different health systems, and therefore different expectations.
Yes.
Cultural expectations, as well as sort of organizational or I suppose systemic expectations.
Yeah, because
so, yeah,
go on.
It just absolutely that grounding of, I mean, I think I had a bit of a pause in the middle to have a third baby, so I probably attended about 60 births over the course of those 10 years. Or at least supported 60 families, may not have attended all the births. But it's an amazing grounding, right?
Yeah.
Where student midwives are meant to support 40 physiological births, but they aren't necessarily all normal unfolding physiological births. You know, they could be vaginal births, but, you know, with some complications along the way, or with additional support, not assisted births, but certainly births with epidural, which just it just changes the mood of it, as you know. And it, all fantastic experience, but it's not the same as witnessing a woman who is experiencing all the hormones of labor and birth, and experiencing her environment just as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you and I are both very privileged in that we have experience in the Middle East as well as here. I mean, you far more so on the ground, but I've done a fair bit of teaching out there and therefore have heard so many stories of people birthing in very different contexts. Yeah. And in the UK, I'm very grateful that we have a primarily midwifery-led model of maternity care, because I think that puts the emphasis more on physiological birth.
Yeah.
Not that, let's be totally clear, like certainly as a doula, I am not there to promote a particular kind of birth, but to have that respect for the body and physiology, I think is so important. And it's I've just been so aware over the years of how much fear there exists within obstetrics and around doctors. And that makes me so sad. And again, I think, you know, relating to what you've been writing in the book, they too must be really facing a lot of those mega mountains.
Yes. And you know, I could have written this for maternity staff, and I hope lots of maternity staff, including obstetricians, will read it. And there was something about writing it for midwives. I was like, I need to claim the space for midwives.
Of course.
But it's an interesting question, right? Because actually you reach a broader base and engage perhaps in those conversations with doctors in a different way when you've written it for them too. But I just felt like there was a gap there for midwives themselves. And actually, funnily enough, when you mentioned the Middle East, I had a sudden moment, Sophie, where I suddenly realized you've been doing nurturing birth courses out there, haven't you? And that's where it all began, really, for me in Abu Dhabi. With Elizabeth Bain and others back in the day, and we started Doulas of the Middle East back then. Feeling that excitement that the legacy continues.
Absolutely.
It's phenomenally different systems. I mean, a few public hospitals, which because of reasonable leadership are ostensibly midwifery led, but mostly private. So it's easy to forget, you know, how we need to appreciate really that midwifery led model and that we are world leading in it, even though we sit here in our own struggles.
Yeah, absolutely. So you share some really sobering statistics in the book. You talk about the WHELM studies, not something that I'd come across before, but you were sharing that, here's the one that really sat with me, 83% of midwives report moderate and above levels of burnout. Two-thirds of participants in that trial, so about 2,000 participants, had thought about leaving the profession in the last 6 months. This is really, really worrying. I mean, we've seen, because of the number of midwives reaching retirement age, we've seen a lot of, you know, kind of old school midwives leaving, and it sounds like there's not enough coming in at the beginning now. And what you're sharing is that, I mean, you know, more than 4/5 of midwives are experiencing real burnout and thinking about leaving.
And that study was done in 2019.
And that was pre-pandemic, which, I mean, you know, put so much more pressure on the system, didn't it? Where is that now? Like, you know, 3 years on from the pandemic, I'm aware as a doula and, you know, in supporting lots of doulas around the world that things shifted considerably and that they haven't necessarily kind of gone back, so that we are still facing some restrictions in places, you know, only one birth partner allowed still in some counties or trusts. What's your perception of that at the moment?
I think it's very, very gradually returning a sense of I say normality, but there is no normality, right? Because the whole landscape's shifted, not just because of COVID and our new awareness of what pandemics look like. But I think it's also because, what is it? I mean, the situation with midwives has changed as well. And I think that's really, really clear to see. those numbers that you just quoted, and obviously there have been studies, 2021 studies, that were saying 57% of midwives were saying they wanted to leave in the next 6 months. We're not seeing those numbers leaving, but we are seeing a lot leaving. We're seeing, and have done for years, a major attrition within the first 2 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And then, and obviously student midwife numbers, I think more are dropping out now than previously. Yeah. Because of that feeling of what on earth is going on and what am I coming into?
Yeah.
And then there's there are lots of band sixes leaving, so sort of midwives mid-career as well.
Yeah.
Making decisions to do something different.
Yeah.
Because it's impacting their lives and well-being.
Yeah, we get a lot of midwives coming across and wanting to be doulas.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I read about them sometimes in doula magazines, and
it's always been interesting for me that flow to and from midwifery from the doula world. And the most senior, I wasn't going to say oldest, the most senior former midwife that we had come and do a doula training with us was 74.
Amazing.
Oh, she was
so exciting.
God, I love her so much. And she...
Maybe I'll come back then, Sophie.
Yeah. Of course you will. But I just loved that those decades of knowledge, and she still just had this deep, deep desire to be with people. And it was just glorious. My concern, and I think this is, you know, something that you really, really go into in the book, is that those who are staying are having more, are facing more and more challenges, and particularly those psychological, mental challenges. You talk about moral injury. I'd love to dive into that more. Compassion, fatigue, burnout, trauma, and the impact of those challenges and how they impact how they show up with the birthing people.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about that.
Great question. Like, because we're asking two questions there, aren't we? How do they show up in midwives, and then how do they impact the whole environment, and how do they work themselves out as such? Lots to say there. Obviously, that's the first half of the book. And just to say also that it's, you know, I'm talking about the realities, and I'm deliberately doing that because what I'm trying to do is create a map for midwives so they can say, okay, so there is a thing happening here. It's not me, and it's not just me experiencing this. Yeah.
And it's not internalizing, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
It's my fault. I am to blame. I'm not good enough.
Yeah, because there's actually a graphic in the book which shows a little sort of paper person cut out saying, I'm not cut out for this. Yeah. And that's what I was hearing. Midwives saying, I'm too old, too young, too tired, too ill, too confused, or too upset, any one of those to carry on with this. And what I really wanted was for midwives to see that it's unacknowledged traumatic stress that's causing that feeling, and that they're not alone in that.
Yeah.
And unacknowledged, very, very well-known things like burnout, you know, which is classified as a occupational hazard. It's an occupational illness. And the WHO, you know, clearly document it. And yet we don't have a way of calibrating where people are on a... There are burnout scales out there, but they're not things that we use in daily practice.
Right.
You know, there is research out there which helps us to think about burnout and implications, but in terms of hitting that wall, we tend to hit it before any, you know, before we get support or assistance with it, rather than doing what we do with the families, which is to go, where are we on the red, amber, green scale? And actually, we can be doing that as midwives in practice in very micro ways, and there can be systems that support us to go, how am I feeling now?
Yeah.
What's needed in order to sustain me and restore me, et cetera, et cetera. But the mega mountains, I start with moral injury, and that's because it's so significant for midwives and doulas actually to think about, how am I contravening my own values in this moment?
Yeah.
How am I stepping over the things that are most important to me because I'm trying to fulfill institutional needs or follow a momentum that's been kind of preordained, whether that's from a guideline or just because of pressures in the system? And I think a lot about antenatal care, but particularly antenatal ward as regards moral injury, because, you know, fundamentally we want to do no harm.
Yep.
And fundamentally, we want to be with woman and her priorities, whatever they are. And, you know, every midwife comes into midwifery wanting to do that. And yet sometimes we set up systems which make it almost impossible. And the induction process is one of those systems where if we really look hard at ourselves and really look hard at what we're inviting families into, we're creating issues. We all know that.
Yeah.
We're creating potentially massive delays, which then causes further issues, clinical issues. And it's very hard to be with. And that's what moral injury is. It's saying, how can I go on, given that I'm doing something which is creating harm, essentially?
So it's that thing, if I understand you rightly, it's that thing of, I know that the hospital, the trust guideline policy protocol is X, Y, and Z. That doesn't sit well with me for any number of reasons. And yet I'm still having to be the mouthpiece, the spokesperson for that protocol.
And there may be elements of it which are completely justifiable with robust evidence behind it.
Yeah.
And the superstructure is a big question mark over what risk really means.
Yes.
And, you know, most of it is driven by some very worthy initiatives that are seeking to save babies, essentially. And you guys, you know, all doulas know this. And what we're sacrificing in the meantime is many other things.
Yeah.
Including women's emotional health.
It's painful, isn't it? Because, you know, we actually, on our courses, we have a significant module around induction because it brings up so much emotion for people. Mm. So many people who come into doula training, if they've had their own birth experiences, pregnancies, for so many people, they have had an induction experience. Or heard of an induction experience, or really had to fight the system around something. And so we really spend time thinking about it and giving people the opportunity to process their own experiences, which I think is so fundamental for anybody working in or around the birth world, is that we're not bringing in our own trauma or baggage. We've got to be clear and clean to work with the people in front of us, but also thinking about, what is my role, considering boundaries, considering expectations? What is my role when it comes to supporting a client who is being given this as an option? You know, how do I help somebody navigate that, knowing my own personal feelings about it?
Yes.
Etc.
Yeah, really difficult. Really, really difficult. And actually, for a doula in a personal relationship with that couple or client, you know, it's even more difficult for a midwife who is working on an or people are moving through. You could argue it's less difficult because it's the way it is, and you're there to do a job, and you can have good connection with someone, and you can be very honest about the road that might be ahead.
Yeah,
and you can give, you know, have a good conversation around consent, all of which will take time, which you may not feel you have, but you can still sort of live to your values, live out your values in that moment in terms of the connection and the conversations and the consent process.
Yeah.
There is greater moral injury when you feel as if there is no time to do that and you're shortchanging people all the time.
Yeah.
And I think every midwife would recognize that as, and of course, moral injury can happen in all sorts of contexts. It was originally talked about in the context of war and conflict, originally in the 1990s. But it can happen all over the system. It's just that it's a particularly pointy place, as you say, induction. And I love what you said about needing to be clean and clear as we come to families in terms of our own experiences and feelings, because I've written a little chapter in the book called When Midwives Give Birth.
Yes.
And it is only a little chapter because there is no research out there, zero research about midwives having given birth and what it means, what the implications are for their practice.
Yeah.
So that's absolutely fascinating in itself.
Oh, it really is. I have such a vivid memory of supporting a client through a birth and being told by the then supervisor of midwives, I know that role doesn't exist anymore. I'm giving you one of our, because she, I knew the supervisor, fabulous, fabulous midwife. And she said, oh, I'm giving you this really lovely midwife. She's just come back from maternity leave. And there was definitely something going on for this midwife. I mean, I think it literally was her first or second shift back after birth. And yeah, it was a really uncomfortable and difficult experience. And so I'm sure that, you know, our own personal experiences impact us. I'm sure, as you point out in the book, that the things that we witness, the things you talk about, secondary trauma, like vicarious trauma, the things that we read about the patients or the clients, the families that we're supporting, that those can have a significant impact on us too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in terms of midwives, had a baby or planning to have, because that's another thing, right? How does the experience of being a midwife then impact our perceptions and our choices around birth and parenting? And there's very little research on that as well. But the book presents reflective questions at the end of each chapter to get midwives to stir things up and go, well, how's this affecting me? What are my feelings about this? Who do I need to talk to now? What kind of conversations are going to be necessary to get clear on this? So the intention is to go, well, how might it have affected me? But yeah, it's such a vital area for us to really look into and to create time to reflect. So a midwife coming back from maternity, even though you're going into a similar environment that might be a trigger space for you, it might be the very space where you've had a baby, at least in the trust that I'm aware of, there isn't a formal process for sort of supporting with reflective practice before re-entry. It's not part of the process. So yeah, that would be an awesome thing for midwives, doulas to work together on, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's such an important area.
I remember somebody saying to me once that midwives and obstetricians are automatically categorized as high risk pregnancies.
Really?
Yep. purely because of what they have seen, witnessed in the bathroom.
So yeah. Who was it who said that to you?
Do you know what? I cannot for the life of me remember. And it was probably about a decade ago, but it stuck with me that there would be this kind of automatic categorization of somebody who works in that world as a high risk. And I tend to avoid that term.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. I mean, of course, midwives, the exposure can also mean that midwives know the right questions to ask. They know, they know what to avoid in terms of the channels, and they know who to surround themselves with.
Yeah.
Just as doulas know what to do to create that bubble.
Yep.
Midwives can do that for themselves as well. I think that's harder for obstetricians because they may have peers, you know, obstetric allies who can provide some of that for them. And they may indeed be obstetricians who have great relationships with midwives who can provide that for them.
Yeah.
But I think that's harder because of their training as well. And they have, you know, even less exposure to completely normal birth.
Yeah. I mean, I had the most incredible conversation with a consultant obstetrician back in 2012 now, who shall remain nameless, who shared that she had not seen a physiological birth until after she completed all of her training and was a birth partner to her own, a family member. And I almost fell off my chair. And she said,
shocking,
and it made so much sense to me. She said, because in this country, in the UK, which is where we are based, she said the role of the obstetrician is to come and solve problems because we are primarily a midwifery-led model. And it made so much sense to me, but it also made sense of why there is a lot of fear, or I've witnessed a lot of fear amongst obstetricians.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is changing in some places.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, I think there is more of an acknowledgement that there are many things that we can do to support the physiology. I think there is a greater awareness of that. And of course, extra pressures on the system, and that means shortage of obstetricians as well as midwives, means that there's every incentive for things to go well.
Exactly.
So, you know, the environment, but also biomechanics, you know, whatever we can do, it's that, and that's kind of seen as a specialism of midwives and but other birth workers, you know, people who can do things that require very little human input.
Interesting. Yeah, that's definitely been on my radar recently, a lot more discussion of biomechanics. So yeah, I'm interested to explore that more. Kate, tell me, you mentioned at the beginning that you were a continuity of carer midwife. What does that mean for you in terms of how you work with families?
Well, I actually am a home birth midwife. I'm just not putting that on the back of the book because I'm aware that some people will make assumptions about what that means and about what my life looks like as a result. But I have been in a geographical community continuity of carer team, meaning I look after women and their families from the beginning of pregnancy all the way through, may or may not be at the birth, and then offer some postnatal care. So try and offer as much as possible. So I've done that geographically. And more recently, I'm on the home birth team, so I'm able to offer the support all the way through. Again, may not be at the birth because we offer support as a team.
Yeah.
So it could be any one of us attending the birth. But there's that really close sense of knowing the family, knowing the priorities of the woman, and being able to just address everything on all sorts of levels. You know, what I love about being a midwife in that way is that I can touch the harder things, be with, you know, the grief over losing her mother or someone else in the family, be support the transition.
Yeah.
Address that question of, you know, a growing family, what it means to be introducing another child into a family.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm doing all that I need to do as a midwife, but that's the stuff I get the most satisfaction out of.
And that's where I would venture your doulaing is coming in, because it is so much of it is about building relationship and rapport, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I often talk about on the courses that 90% of birth doulaing is in the preparation. It's in those conversations. It is about understanding that there's grief about a loss, or, you know, that so-and-so is squeamish around blood, or something to do with a history. And I think that is all so relevant. And that's what makes me feel so sad about the majority of midwives that I meet and talk to who are outside of a continuity team or a home birth team, where they're meeting somebody who is in labor for the first time. They don't have that knowledge or connection in place. So, you know, my hat goes off to those midwives who are able to build rapport so quickly with people in what is often quite a sort of an intense situation.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. And midwives are really good at it.
Yeah.
And actually those midwives who choose to work on the labor ward, for example, are often the best at building rapport very quickly.
Yeah.
Because that's what they do every day.
Yeah.
And it can be quite fun, because, you know, it's a real challenge in front of you to go, right, who are these people? And obviously you can build it. I mean, you can really invest in those first few minutes, and even just sitting with someone and having a conversation that's very much eye to eye and including the partner and, you know, naming a little bit about what's ahead or what might be ahead and what they, in exploring what they want, you know, those 5 minutes can make all the difference in terms of how the rest of the day or night goes.
Yeah, 100%.
And people are brilliant at that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, Kate, the second part of the book is diving in and helping midwives to explore what they can do to change things, to support themselves. The theme of this second season of the podcast is what I wish people knew. I'm sure there are many, many things that you wish people knew. What really kind of stands out for you when it comes to Flourish and these midwives?
Yeah. What I wish people knew is more about themselves. So the first part of the part two of the book is the self, passion, purpose, really understanding what it is that motivates me as a midwife, what got me into it in the first place, what still keeps the fire burning when I really dig down and look.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of unpacking around who am I? What does my voice sound like? What are my values? What do I really stand for? And in what ways do I feel diminished or crushed if my values aren't being honoured, I suppose, in the work that I'm doing?
Yeah.
And really getting people to think about, you know, their ideal week or month even, and how that might play out in the choices that they make in terms of the type of jobs that they go for, because midwifery is a very, very broad spectrum actually, and you can find things that suit different people. And the notion of everyone needing to do everything it's defunct, and it doesn't work because people get burnt out as a result. So that's the first part, really going, who am I, what does my voice sound like, and if there was to be one small project that I engaged in with a tribe of people around me who are all interested too, what would it be?
Yeah.
And that's not in an attempt to kind of load another thing onto a midwife. It's about a reconnection to that fire of interest, that fire of desire in the first place, and saying, if I plug into this, how might that give me more energy? We know that being proactive is a mitigator against burnout. And, you know, most midwives will say, oh my goodness, I barely have enough energy to, you know, get up in the morning and go to the shift, let alone adding something else. But there's something there about something that you are really passionate about changing, being able to ignite you once again.
Yeah.
Particularly if you found a group of people around you who can do it with you.
Yeah. So connection and community.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah. You talk, actually, I was very interested. You mentioned self-care, the old notion of self-care, i.e. that being the midwife's responsibility. You know, I've got to look after me. Whereas you kind of suggest this new idea, which is the community of care, you have this opportunity to support one another within, and for the responsibility to be part of the team rather than the individual.
Yeah, exactly. It's collective responsibility. And that, of course, means the structures that are set up, the processes that enable people to have the space to reflect, be together. All of those things are important.
Which doesn't really exist as far as I'm
aware. No, not really.
Which is,
not really.
I mean, if you think of the things that midwives are seeing on a daily basis, to not have opportunities for debriefing and reflecting and, you know, trauma support blows my mind.
It's extraordinary. A psychologist friend of mine was talking to me about this, and she said that she does about 24 sessions a week, and her requirement professionally is to have a supervision for every 8 sessions. So she has 3 supervisions a week. So she's able to do that debriefing that's needed. And she was aghast at the fact that midwives mostly aren't getting anything. And many midwives would say, oh, I don't really know how I'd use it, or I'm not sure I really need it. But often that's probably coming from a place of just never having had it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And therefore not knowing what's possible when you slow down and have those kind of conversations. And also how you can begin to then generate ideas from those and space for creativity and also space, courage actually, to have the more difficult conversations when you are on the shop floor.
Yeah.
Finding it difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that ties in actually with the doula world. So when I first started out as a doula, there was a suggestion that you go through a recognition process with a mentor, that you do a certain number of births or postnatal jobs, and that you debrief those, and then off you go into the world. And we have completely changed the way that we approach mentoring at Nurturing Birth, and it's our recommendation that everybody have mentoring ongoing throughout, because we never stop being exposed to new things. We will always be activated in some way from the things that we hear, the things that we see. So I think it's fundamental for people to have that level of support. And just having a mate you chat to is different. It's not the same at all.
No, it's different.
I really wish that comes in for midwives.
Yeah. And you're right, having a mate that you chat to can sometimes, you know, be a vulnerable situation as well, because we tend to tell stories. You know, midwives we've always been storytellers, actually. It's been part of our sort of way of being. But it's easy to story slime each other.
Yes.
And just sort of let it spill out.
Yeah.
And I talk in the book about this this phrase, she was hosing, as in losing a lot of blood all at the same time.
Yeah, when I read that, I was like, oh, that's such a graphic image.
I know. And people use that phrase from a place, some people have experienced it, and of course it is horrendous and horrific. And it's a place of, for the midwife, or anyone in the room, frankly, complete powerlessness.
Yeah.
Because it's overwhelming and incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
And we know that powerlessness is a massive trigger for PTSI because you're immobilized in the system. You know, the nervous system just is shut down. You're in freeze in that moment.
Yeah.
But I talk about the fact that the phrase is used and it becomes a kind of fear totem. Even though the majority of people haven't experienced that, because mostly the body's very effective at doing what it's doing. And also we're very effective at managing situations before they become serious. But it can still, like, these things end up growing wings, and these phrases can become, people can become attached to them, and they can create that fear in the system, even when the majority of people haven't experienced it.
Yeah. So it's creating drama, isn't it? And I suppose I relate that to, we talk a lot about the media representation of birth.
Yeah.
And how people often share their negative birth stories.
Yes. You know,
when someone's pregnant, oh my God, when my baby was born, I mean, to use your phrase, I was hosing out, or, you know, something horrific. And it's putting so much fear into. But I think that's often, it's a trauma response from the person who witnessed it or had that experience themselves, isn't it?
So I talk in the book about how to regulate those conversations.
Yeah.
And seeking comes from the work of Françoise Mathieu, who wrote the Compassion Fatigue Handbook and runs an organization in Canada. But she talks about really asking permission at different stages of that conversation, including at the beginning of, you know, asking someone if they're okay to hear a story now. So it's kind of permission seeking as you go to avoid that spill into someone else's life and for them to be carrying that. Yeah. Now, of course, many midwives will say, well, I don't mind, you know, it's part of the way in which I engage and support my colleagues and my friends. And, you know, that's what brings me relief to have had these conversations. But I guess it's just fine-tuning the awareness around it.
There's the light and shade. So, I mean, you and I are both coaches. We both work around trauma. We've both been in the birth world a long time. There, what I observe, what I notice, is a lot of people who are drawn to this kind of work often have codependency issues and that desire to prioritize other people's feelings and needs, to be put other people in front of themselves. So, you know, my colleague, my doula colleague has had an awful experience. I must be there to support them without actually thinking necessarily about how that might impact on me.
Yeah.
And what do I do when I am holding that information that someone has given me?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, potentially the same with these midwives who are, I'm here.
Which can be very visual.
Yeah, very visual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we know that, you know, that visual part of the brain, when you're in a kind of trauma exposed state, is very, very highlighted. So that part of the brain is the thing that's going to be giving you those flashbacks.
Yeah.
And that's not just for visual people, that's for everyone.
That's amygdala kicking off monkey.
Yeah, and it's another part of the brain as well, which is, and Bessel van der Kolk talks about this,
yes,
and the body keeps the score.
Yes,
but the part, it's amazing, right? The parts of the brain which can process words completely shuts down, and the part which is about visual is highlighted, is elevated.
So
it becomes a kind of source of those horrendous, very visceral flashbacks. Anyway, do you see we've started talking about part one again?
We have. We've come back full circle. So we need to wrap up, although I feel like we could carry on talking for hours. Maybe we need to have a part two of this at some point.
What we haven't really talked about is just those, you know, ways in which midwives or doulas can be supporting
that
themselves.
Was going to be my final question, was what do you feel is the ultimate or greatest way that a midwife can support themselves as they stay in this midwifery career?
The greatest way, now that's a question, Sophie.
It's quite a big one, isn't it? And I suspect, you know, it is going to be personal preference will play a big part.
Yeah. And I think getting yourself surrounded by a group of people who get you, and who can encourage you to go for the things that really suit you, is massive. That's really important. Discovering more about who you are and what your preferences are, what your personality is drawn towards, and what you stand for is really important. And then there's the day-to-day, and actually the book's full of tiny day-to-day exercises which will help sustain midwives to just breathe in that moment, to, and I say just, you know, very lightly, because obviously it's at the heart of everything, to move the body when the mind is stuck, to choose to adopt mindset or explore mindsets which might create a new possibility. So there's that feeling of hope, and that's what I, you know, would love midwives to take away, that there's a grain of hope which can flourish into something bigger.
And I love that word flourish. It feels really generous and exciting. And and I love the mention of breath, because as you know, I'm a breathwork practitioner. I am passionate about the breath and the power of the breath.
Yeah.
And how there are so many very, very simple breathing techniques. I think when people talk about breathwork, they're often a bit freaked out. You know, they see sort of Wim Hof and things like that and think, oh my God, that's not for me.
Extreme.
But, yeah, quite extreme. And let's all sit in an ice tub, which, you know, I have done, but thinking about how we utilize like really simple techniques to just bring us back to equilibrium.
Yeah.
So if anyone's interested, I'm more than happy to talk more about that at some point.
Yes. And understanding how the nervous system can just be regulated very quickly.
Yes.
You know, we're quite straightforward in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of complexity here, but there's also a simplicity that we don't access.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Kate, it's been such a joy talking to you.
Such a pleasure.
And I'm so excited about your book coming out. So tell us more about, where can people find out more about the book and about you? How can they contact you?
Yeah, you can go to flourishformidwives.com. So that's the website, and everything on there is obviously about the book and the movement and what we're trying to do. There's also a trauma exposure poster on there that I'm exploring embedding in trusts so that there's something very visual that midwives can see and have conversations around what it means to have robust processes in place to support after an incident. But yeah, the links to the book, the buttons to buy the book are all on there as well. So flourishformidwives.com. I'm also trying to get the book into the hands of all 40,855 midwives on the NMC register in this country, in the UK. And to try and do that by inviting grateful parents to buy a book for a midwife.
Wow.
So I'm setting up a page on the website, which will be linked to QR codes that enable parents to access the code and then go through to their local hospital, anyone who wants to be part of the scheme, so that they can buy a book for a midwife and they start piling up a bit like Harry Potter with the letters coming through. Books just start arriving for midwives and then every single person can have one.
I mean
student midwives and midwifery support workers as well, and if they want to, obstetricians, absolutely, as long as they're not put off by the fact it says midwifery on the cover.
I would highly recommend all doulas to read this book. I think there is a huge amount in it for doulas to think about as well. So I'm excited, Kate, about what's coming on the back of this, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
And lovely, thank you for joining us. See you soon.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Nurturing Birth Doula podcast. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you've got any questions or any feedback, don't hesitate to come back to us. It's info@nurturingbirth.co.uk. And do follow us on social media @nurturing_birth on Instagram and Twitter. And you can find us on Facebook as well. Please do give us a review if you've enjoyed this episode. We are on Spotify, we're on Apple, and we would love to hear your thoughts about any future episodes you'd like to hear. So do get in touch. Thanks for listening. Bye.